Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Living History. It's great to be here again. And we are joined by someone who I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing from. He's been on the show several times before. He does another podcast, which is Pete and Gary's Military History, which we love here as well. It's our sister podcast. He knows everything there is to know about military history, and we've got him on to talk about a very specific and really interesting topic. I know this is going to be a very popular podcast. We're talking basically about tank crews during the Second World War. Joining me from London is historian Peter Hart. Pete, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Matt. We like to think of ourselves as your brother podcast.
That's a good point. The gender-neutral twins we are. So,
all right,
it's been great, mate. The podcast has been fantastic. We've been doing it for a couple of years now with your chum Gary Bain, and geez, you've covered some interesting topics I didn't even think could fill a 10-minute podcast. You've managed to wrap it on for an hour about. It's quite a skill.
Well, we've learnt a lot because, of course, sometimes we have to step outside our own knowledge. People will say we don't know much about anything, but I found things like the Waterloo really opened up. Waterloo podcasts, I think we've done three or four of them now, and the ones on something I share with you, the inability to say Isandlwana. I remember listening to
Isandlwana, as in the British battlefield. Yeah,
yes.
Zulu Wars. Just say the Zulu Wars.
Yeah. Zulu Wars. Yeah, and that they've opened up great interests for me. And with military history, it's good to get outside of just the very small things you do. And in a way, you see the Second World War and Burning Steel, the other books I've done on the Second World War. They're stepping out. The First World War, the Great War, is my main thing, as you know. So it's good to get out and about.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you say that, because I know that is your backstory. You and I it's been a lot of beers under the bridge that you and I have spent together over the years. But I would say lately, people that are recent converts to the Peter Hart military history experience would probably know you as a Second World War guy, because the volume of work that you've done recently has been very Second World War focused, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's what it does is it sort of reflects my career at the War Museum, because I started on the Great War, and that's what I am. I'm a Great War historian. But then because of work, my job interviewing veterans, the First World War veterans had gone. And so I was doing, for 20, 30 years, I did nothing but Second World War, Korean War veterans. And those Second World War veterans, I did in a way that by concentrating on a specific unit, it sort of opened the way to doing a series of podcasts. For instance, we did one on the 2nd Royal Norfolk Regiment. We did a whole series of interviews to them, 50-odd. No, 50-odd's the number we normally do. And then that moved on to whoever they were, South Knots Hussars.
South Knots Hussars, yeah.
What a memory I have. and then the second Fife and Forfa Yeomanry, which is the subject of Burning Steel, which was the book that came out recently about them.
I do have a copy of that here. It is a great read.
I can see it's really well thumbed.
It is. It's almost pristine. This is a topic that we have, you know, from various angles have approached recently, because you're in the middle of a fantastic series of podcasts on this topic. You know, it reflects the great work that you did that we're all indebted to you for, the great work you and the other oral historians at the Imperial War Museum. And this podcast is going to be a chat loosely based on the fact you've got this fantastic new book out, Burning Steel, and to talk about the tankers in the Second World War, but also to talk about these things that we love nattering about when we're in the pub, which is the importance of oral history, you know, what's happening with history at the moment. You mentioned the other two projects that you worked on in terms of the South Notts Hussars and the Royal Norfolk Regiment. So you did an artillery one with South Notts Hussars, infantry with the Royal Norfolk Regiment, and now the tank crews. Just give us a little bit of an overview, because you said that this is slightly different to the way you did some Great War stuff. I mean, give us an overview of this concept of interviewing several people from the same unit and the way that tells a story.
Well, that all comes from, we tried to do it in the First World War, but that was in the 1980s. And to be honest, you'd get one person from the 7th Battalion Northumberland Regiment, Northumberland Fusiliers. You'd get a couple from, let's say, the 1st, 8th Durham Light Infantry. And one of those would be good and one wouldn't. And you were lucky if you get those odds. So when we started with the Second World War, we had an interviewer called Conrad Wood, who just interviewed hundreds of people. He would do three or four interviews, sort of two-hour interviews at most. And it was basically, what's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you? And it would be the big war stories, their big war story. And that would be fundamentally what it was. Whereas I was doing a completely different thing, which was I was doing, could you tell me when and where you were born, a bit about their background, growing up, what jobs they had, how they joined the army, how they got into the unit, what their reception was in the unit, how they were trained, which covers all the how this bangy thing works and that bangy thing, how you drive a tank, you know, the tillers.
I think that's a technical term, isn't it? Bangy things?
Yeah, bang for guns. Yeah, sorry. I do use a lot of obtuse.
We don't want it to fly over people's heads, Pete. We might need to dumb it down with the jargon a little bit.
Sorry, mate. Yeah, I'll keep right. What we discovered was that if I do sort of 50, 60 people from a unit, then of that, if you sort of 40 of them will be good, 10 won't be so good. That's just human nature. Some people's memories go quicker than others. Some people don't particularly cooperate as well. They just don't want to. And what you get is you get them all. They're all in the same unit. So anything that happens is happening to them all. And I always use the same analogy, but the people have probably seen me before. If you hold your hand up, there's gaps between them, right? So if you interview two people, there's a lot less gaps. Now imagine 50 hands. I only have two. If you imagine 50 hands, you can see that there's not going to be things missed out. You're going to get a complete picture, and everybody's talking about the same thing. So instead of talking about generic officers, you're talking about a specific officer. And people, there'll be outliers, there'll be people who say, oh, I bloody hated him, oh, he's the best officer that ever lived. And then there'll be people who say, well, he was pretty good, you know, he had a couple of faults, he didn't like Englishmen. That's quite a common thing in the 5th Forfa, partly because we can't pronounce Forfa. You get the outliers, but what you do get is you get, so if there's an attack, and like, for instance, I always remember the 18th of July when they Operation Goodwood, they're all talking about the same things. You've got people, and people can see each other's tanks, and people are actually talking about the same thing. Now, that means you get a real picture, and often, if you haven't done this, it's all preparatory work. And people say, oh, when did you do this? Well, I did it in the very late 90s. And then I wrote the book. Well, I wrote the book 3 years ago, I suppose. I can't remember. I wrote it. And that's when you do it. You're sort of using that work. And then to that, you add the war diary, of course. That's to keep people in line. Because if I asked you what date you met me, you wouldn't know. Obviously, it'd be a memorable day for you, and you'll remember it was in a bar in Canberra.
I remember the day well. I couldn't tell you what date it was, but the event is burned in my memory.
So you have a war diary that gives you, I mean, so you can't, you know, when somebody, some old fella says, oh, I can't remember what date something happens, you can look it up in the war diary, which is, although you don't entirely trust war diaries, dates they're pretty accurate on, and you get this... you then have some people have left personal experience accounts, which are in the libraries, with the 54 files, as I call them, I'm afraid. Then there's a chap called Steele Brownlee. William Steele Brownlee, but he never used his first name. And he left a brilliant account, which was in the War Museum. And because of COVID, I couldn't get at it. But a chap called Rob Stout, thank you, Rob, sent it me. And that was another invaluable. And what you have is you have these, you need checkpoints. You can't just trust oral history. If I said to you, I got up at 5 o'clock this morning, do you know it's true or not? How do you know? And if it was 50 years time, definitely how do you know? Well, you'll be dead, so will I. But, you know, the point remains that you need things to check things. And I've always felt that there's no such thing as objective historical truth, but you can get a balance of probability, and that's what I search for. If something is unbelievable, it's probably not true, is one of my golden rules. It's why I'm skeptical about certain First World War aces' claims, that kind of thing. I'm not going to name them, but don't want any Canadians on my back. but you see what I mean. You disregard if something's unbelievable or fanciful or over embroidered. For instance, I'm always suspicious of people who remember what people said. Look out, said Ted, as a shell burst. You know, I can't remember what I said yesterday. Can you? And you're a professional broadcaster as opposed to a strolling idiot like myself. So,
has a book out at the moment, Pete. So I think that
you've got that a book out. You've got a book out on that escape.
I do indeed. Thank you. Thanks for the plug. Cowra Breakout coming out next week, actually.
It's great. Yeah, it's coming
this,
soon.
We should get on to talking specifically about the topic, sorry. But I just, you know that I always get distracted by, it's such a fascinating world.
I'm very distracting.
That is very true. I do always get distracted by you, Pete, but also I get distracted by the subject of oral history with war veterans.
Yeah.
Mostly because I didn't get to do very much of it because I came to this. It might not be obvious, but I'm considerably younger than you. And so I didn't get, particularly with the First World War, which is my great passion, I only got to meet a handful of veterans and certainly didn't have the opportunity to sit down and interview them as you did. When you're doing something like this with the tank crews in World War II, are you steering the conversation? Do you, for example, when you did these interviews, did you talk to one veteran who said, an extraordinary thing happened to me on the 26th of September 1944, hypothetically? And then you're going, wow, I really want to flesh that out. So I'll find out what other people witnessed at the same thing. Are you sort of building a tapestry yourself about what went on, or are you just letting them talk and tell their stories?
No, very much. Well, I always used to call it like that, keeping people on course, which you desperately try and do with me. And you just did a gear shift there. And that's what we do. So if there's something big happens, I'll make a note of it. And when I interview other people, I'll ask them about the same thing. I try not to tell people what happened. You have to be really careful because if you lead them too much, then you'll get people. The thing about people who are interviewing is they want to please you. They're little old men. They often haven't spoken to anyone quite recently, or if they have, it's only been the wife. and they're keen to be. So if you say, I was just saying, First World War analogy, of course, with me, it must have been cold in the trenches. You'll get a typical answer. Yes, it was cold. Yes, cold, freezing. I was never cold, though. And it's only the last one, because if they're from the north of England, obviously Scotland's different. For some reason, they get cold again in Scotland. But you get used to something, and they've got the fires. Do you see what I mean? And if you've led them, you get contradictory answers, and often it's the last answer that will be what they really think. The other thing, the whole thing with oral history is you always have to be aware that if you treat it as old men rambling on, like I'm old now, I'm the same age as the people I was interviewing in the 1990s, 67. And people are in good condition when they're 67. But on the other hand, if you think of it as old men rambling on with points of extreme interest, you don't get this sort of calling it testimony. I'm glad you haven't used the word testimony because my eyebrow would have gone up. Because testimony gives it the idea that it's some sort of semi-religious legal. This is the truth. We must all bow before this veteran who hath spoken. And that's not what it is. They're just people, like anybody who writes down a diary or writes a personal experience account. You have to treat it as the evidence and look at it and analyze it properly as a historian. So all history is part of the all arms battle, to use again the First World War analogy. I told you First World War was my thing.
I like what you did there, Pete. Very good.
Yeah. But you use all things. So if you've got pictures, you know, somebody says every tank's on fire and there's a picture of the battlefield and they're not on fire, you've got to balance in your head what were the different sources of evidence. Picture will probably be from a different day, you never know. But you do look at all the evidence, the war diary, personal experience accounts, everything, and oral history slots between them. Burning Steel and my other book, Close Range, other books, are often mainly oral history. And there it's different. What you're doing is making sure it's as right as it can be. But then the beauty is you get the people telling their story in a way that you and I can't tell for them. So what's it like to be in a Sherman, the Ronson, Light's first time, the Tommy Cooker? What's it like to be in a Sherman? How do you feel rumbling into action? How do you feel? What does it smell like? And not just the fact that the bloke steering the thing has farted. And that guy. I mean, what about all the other smells, the fuel and the cordite, everything else? What do you have personal morale like? It's a posh word for are you scared, bloody rigid? The answer is usually yes. It's just you get that picture. And then when something happens, something happens and they describe it. I remember looking at them and you could see them reacting. They could almost relive it in front of you. And the panic and getting out of the tank. It's so important. How do you get out? We're on soft ground. Can't get through the bottom. I'll have to go through the top. They're in the bloody way. Get out the bloody way. Because they know it's going to catch fire. It doesn't always catch fire immediately. And most of them get out all right. So they get out. What happens when they get out, Matt? They're on a battlefield. What's on a battlefield? Well, machine guns, hand grenades. So when you get a lot of the casualties in tank warfare is escaped crews. A lot of the Fife and Forfar yeomanry casualties at Goodwood were when they got back and they were at the glider field at Ranfield. You've obviously been there.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is where they were bombed by the bloody Germans. No disrespect to Germans, they're all lovely now, but they always do what you don't want them to do. And they bombed them, and a lot of them were killed there. So for me, and you get these interacting stories. And actually, the Ranville bit's really exciting. Some of them are in a glider. One of them burnt to death in a glider that caught fire. That they were just sleeping there. Another one was wounded in the arse. Because he was getting underneath the vehicle and a bit of the bomb hit him in the arse. Do you see what I mean? And then you have the stories of the men taken away in the ambulances. And I'm using that it's an unknown thing, the bombing of the glider field. It's not particularly well known. And it comes out in oral history because that's what they remember. But for me, I found the book incredibly exciting, very moving at times. Charlie Workman, who's someone I still remember interviewing in Musselburgh in far off near Edinburgh, and he remembered seeing this officer, one of his friends, his tank was hit, and he tried that it had taken his legs off the shell. It hit in the turret, and a lot of them lost their legs when that happened. And he tries to climb out. The tank now catches fire, and then he just sees him fall back into the tank. I find that horrendous. There's no joking on the podcast. We often have to make it clear before a podcast whether it's going to be a ha ha Pete and Gary or it's going to be a fairly serious affair. And there's nothing funny about warfare generally. It's training that's funny.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But the other thing is about my sort of book is I believe that if you don't understand the training, you don't understand how people react in action. You ask any soldier, they'll tell you that you're a civilian unless you're trained. You can put a uniform on, but if you've not been trained and properly trained, then when the shit hits the fan, you're going to fail. Almost certainly, unless you're a natural soldier, which barely exists. The noise, Matt. Not just the tank noise, but the noise of the battlefield. That apparently would be enough to scare people like me and you. You've never served in anything, I don't think. Not in the Boy Scouts. Although, I have to beware people who serve in the Boy Scouts too closely. Apparently just the noise is enough. Never mind the people dying left, and other tanks. So for me, it was a very, very exciting, the wrong word, a dramatic book. Because I don't want people to think I get a thrill out of the horror of it. Because I don't. I just find it horrible. But it's somehow, one of the things is, can I make a point?
Please do.
Even when you are only a mere lad of about 32, whereas I'm twice your age. But when you were young, everyone you met, Matt, was every authority figure was a Second World War veteran. I think even for you, that would be true. Your headmaster.
Yeah,
for me, every teacher at my school was either very young, i.e. 3 or 4 years older than me, you know, or they'd been in the Second World War. Bock O'Kelly, deputy head, the headmaster, most of the senior teachers. If you went to the pub, the landlord was a veteran. On the bus driver is a veteran. If you walk down the streets, everyone you saw, my father, of course, all my uncles, they were all Second World War veterans. And they were everywhere. And no one thought anything of them. And one of the reasons I love the books I write is I'm bringing that generation's sacrifice. I don't want to make it. They didn't want to sacrifice anything. They're human beings. They just wanted to have a good time, go down the pub, drink, meet the missus, try not to meet the missus, meet some other people first, then meet the missus. They just wanted a good life. But a lot of them had to. Some made the ultimate sacrifice, but a lot of the rest of them are badly wounded or they're mentally affected or they just have 6 years of their life taken from them. Now, at our age, and I do include you in this, 6 years isn't much. Do you know what I mean? But when you're 18 to 24, that is your life. And you spend that with people trying to kill you. And I think the sacrifice of that generation, the sacrifice of those second Fife and Four Fire Yeomanry and all the other men who served in whatever needs to be recognised. And one of the best ways of recognising it was what the War Museum did, record as many of them as possible, and then in my case, turn that into a book that gives them their voice. There are only two that I'm aware of the veterans left alive. Jeff Hayward, who I'm still in touch with, and a guy called Harold Wilson, which is slightly peculiar for people in my country. All of the rest of the people in that book are dead. And the people they're talking about are dead. Again, it's a slightly sentimental thing, but when they talk about someone who died, I like the fact that their name is remembered, that their lives are given. Somehow just what they did is remembered. So there's me being more sentimental than usual, I suppose. But these books, the At Close Range, this one, Burning Sausages, as I often call it, Burning Steel, and I'm working on one of the 16th Durham Light Infantry, an ordinary infantry regiment. And to me, it's bringing those veterans back to life. It's bringing their experiences and it's making us all think about how very different their lives are from ours. I don't know what you think.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. The interesting thing for me, Pete, is that you have spent a lot of time talking to these veterans. But when you compile it into a book, there must be things that surprise you and shock you. I mean, when you were putting Burning Steel together, what were the elements of it that there must have been times when you just went, wow, that's an extraordinary story that's just been revealed. Can you remember moments or key parts of the book that really, really shocked you or really surprised you?
Some of them I almost suppressed. They're in the book. One of the things was Charlie Workman again. He was very... He tells a story about how they got out of the tank. They got a tank, got caught fire, got hit and caught fire. And they get out and he sort of comes to on the grass because he's sort of in a panic and he looks around and there's this sort of burning raggy thing next to him. And he sort of looks at it. And then the voice comes from, just a voice comes from it saying, "Shoot me, sir." And, and I remembered this story. What I hadn't realized was just the impact it would have on me when I heard it again. Because I listen to everything again, sometimes at fast speed, you know, on computers, you can speed up voices. Now I'd slow down to bits I was going to use in the book. But when he says, I couldn't shoot him. And thank God the voice tailed away and he died. And then you're thinking, thank God he's dead. But that's the state it was. So and stories like that, I'm not going to go into any more because again, it's slightly morbid, but that sort of thing stays with you and that shocks you. It's so awful, and that sort of thing does make its mark on you. It was a sort of renewed shock. And when I heard it, I remembered sitting opposite him, almost with my mouth open, going, "Jesus wept." I'm not sure I want to hear this. It was a lovely old boy.
It's what I think so important about this work, Pete, that you do, and what gets revealed in the books in particular, because you've done great work in oral history, but it requires us to do a lot of work to access it, to go and listen to hours and hours of interviews. That's why the books are so compelling, that you're bringing that story together in a cohesive way. But the thing I've always liked about it is it adds an extra dimension as well. I think that now that the veterans are nearly all gone, the First World War ones are all gone and the Second World War ones are sadly following, there's a danger. I don't know what it's like in the UK, but in Australia, there's this danger that they become two-dimensional. Every Aussie bloke just wanted to kiss his girlfriend goodbye and ride down on a horse to the nearest enlistment station and head off and do his bit for king and country. And some of those elements are true. I'm not saying that they're not, but there's a risk that that becomes the entire story. And what I always come back to with oral history, something we've talked about before on this podcast, when we've talked about oral history, we've talked about it before, that they say things in oral history that they don't say in a letter home, or that they don't put in their diary, or they certainly don't say when they meet the Queen to get a medal pinned on their chest. And it's important stuff. It's important. Even those ghastly stories, we don't want to dwell on them too much as the whole story, but it's important we know them. It's important we understand what people went through when we talk about why it's important to remember. I mean, that must be your bread and butter every day with speaking to these veterans.
It is, and you've hit the net. They're ordinary people doing extraordinary things, and by extraordinary things, I just mean giving up 6 years of their life. That's the start point. But above that is the things they have to do, the skills they learn. It's all amazing stuff, and oral history does bring. I use the example of Gallipoli. That's my favourite topic, and Gallipoli, and we all know what I'm going to say, and it's dysentery. Not mentioned much in letters home to mum. Not mentioned at all in letters home. Do you write to your girlfriend, "Dear darling, have shat myself 14 times today. Used hand and some leaves to wipe my arse with. Arse also red raw." Do you write that home to your mum? I think even to your dad, you're probably just going to say a bit of the old tummy trouble. And I remember a book once about Palestine, boasted it wouldn't use any oral history or non-contemporary material, i.e. letters and diaries of the time. Result, the word dysentery doesn't appear in the index. Yet you and I know there's plenty of dysentery in Palestine. The Palestine campaign. Well, in Gallipoli, oral history, the first thing that's in every interview is people talking about upset tummies and dysentery.
Sorry to jump in there, Pete, but we can't underestimate the effect that had on these campaigns. Entire army was debilitated at times because everyone had dysentery and they were so weak they could barely raise their rifle, let alone fight. This had a profound effect on the way battles were fought in all of these campaigns. And you're right, if you're not talking about it, you're overlooking one of the key components of the way that army operated.
Look at the, is it 4th Brigade, advance round through Taylor's Gap, bit of an error of that, and up to Hill 971. Blamed on Monash sometimes by people who who have got it in for Monash. I don't concur. I mean, he didn't do brilliantly that night. But the real point is that brigade was riddled with dysentery. And it's just, I mean, I couldn't do that if I had an upset tummy, never mind dysentery. Dysentery is different from an upset tummy. It's not 5 pints of beer and an unwise curry or doner kebab from a dodgy store. It isn't. It is dysentery, where you will die if you don't get treatment. And at Gallipoli, the truth is that in the desert in the Second World War, if you got jaundice, you'd be evacuated as sick. At Gallipoli, jaundice just gave you a spot of colour in your face because you had dysentery, you had paratyphoid, and eventually they'd get off when they got soldier's heart, which was disordered action of the heart. That's what you find out from oral history. I used to love the old boys who said, "I was evacuated from Gallipoli with disordered action of heart. Ha ha, he's still going strong 60 years later." You'd see they died 2 days later. Well, that's an exaggeration, but the point. But that's oral history for you. And again, the bringing it back. It's me that keeps leading us away. But Burning Steel, this is tank warfare. This is what it's like, told by the men itself. And although it's going through a filter, the filter being me, I've tried to be fair to the lads. And the veterans who've read it, certainly Jeff Haywood and I believe Harold Wilson, have liked it because they recognise it as being true to life. I haven't put words in their mouth. I've only edited words out. So I don't try and make it a better story. I just try and I cut things, but I don't add things, I think is the way to put it. And I think it reflects what happens as best as anywhere. I think if you want to know about tank warfare, what it was like to be in a Sherman, then I think the lads and I suppose me have done a better job here than I could have dreamt of when I started, the interviews. Because that's the ultimate process. Interviews is part of it. It's not just the writing.
It was a hell of a war they went through, wasn't it, these guys in the tanks? I mean, I've read your other books as well, and it's not to take anything away from the infantry and the artillery and guys that flew planes or on ships or anything else. But, geez, I tell you what, there's a special type of bravery when you go and climb into that metal monster and head off and face the shell fire on a battlefield, isn't there, mate?
There is, and if you ask the infantry, they hate tanks. They don't like being near them because they attract artillery fire. Of course they do. Artillery is the enemy of the tank. And when they're wounded, there's a couple of stories in the book where they wouldn't go in the tank. They would not get in the tank. They were put on the back. They just wouldn't get in it. They were screaming scared of being caught, trapped if it got hit, if the tank got hit. Infantry don't like tanks. I think there is a special sort of courage. I have to say that I think infantry are the people who suffer the most in warfare. But then you might say, is that because you're working on the 16th Durham Light Infantry? And I suspect that all I'm doing at the moment is dealing with infantry accounts. But in the end, they have to take the ground and hold the ground. And they're attacked by tanks, artillery, and other bloody infantry. So they do have a fairly bad time. They don't go back to lager up like the tanks do at night. They stay there.
I learned that many years ago from tank crews that tanks are fantastic at capturing ground and absolutely bloody awful at holding it. So, that's when they do rely on their friends in the infantry to come and come and help them out.
I'm sure they're so friendly. Of course, infantry never ever, as we all know from the podcast, infantry never ever complain. They merely observe, Matt. They observe a lot.
The podcast episodes are something. I mean, we've talked about the general nature of the book here, and in half an hour on this podcast, we obviously can't break down a multi-hundred page book. But you are doing that in your series of podcasts with Gary Bain, and I mean, are you finding when you're doing those podcasts, are you simply summarizing the bits that you did in the book, or are you finding new directions and new angles? And I mean, Gary's always adding new angles that take me by surprise. It's been a really interesting exploration hearing those special episodes on this subject of tank warfare.
They're essentially based on chapters of the book, which have to be much shortened, which is, that's my job. And then Gary adds the new angles, which I haven't thought about. Sometimes he brings in his own experience because he actually served in the army. very undistinguished career. And he was a private for no less than six times, I think. I've been promoted, broken for bad conduct and the rest of it. But and then he rose to be the financial director of Transport for London. So there you go. The army missed him there. Well, they didn't. They had him right, actually. But he changed after that. But Gary looks at things with a different eye from what I do, and that helps a lot. But when they're not scripted, we have notes. I'm sure you have notes when you do your podcast with Peter Smith, good friend of mine. Very camp Royal Marine. I've never heard of a camp Royal Marine before. Give him my regards.
But, I will indeed.
Well, he's a great bloke. But I'm sure you have notes, but that you don't read them. We don't read ours. We read the quotes. The trouble is we're both difficult people. You won't believe this, Matt, that I'm difficult. But the more people complain about accents, the more we do them. And I don't know
why
that is.
That's one of my favourite things. The feedback we get is, why do you idiots continue with your terrible accents? And I'm like, why? Why? Please don't say that. You know you're only encouraging them.
We don't do them during the battle scenes. We absolutely don't. But you know, it just amuses us while we do. I mean, we have to do a podcast a week and it keeps us happy. And without it, there probably wouldn't be a podcast because it amuses us. And I sit opposite Gary when he's doing his Germans, which always turn out to be a gay Manfred von Richthofen. And you just think, what? And when Blücher turned out to be a gay Manfred von Richthofen, there was a howl of complaint from the punters. And so after that, he was a more butch Manfred von Richthofen. The one that caused most complaints that I fondly remember was the colonel of the 2nd Royal Norfolk, a chap called Robert Scott. And he was larger than life. He was huge, 6'4", which was tall then. It's not tall now. Huge monster of a man who never did anything without shouting and, you know, bawling. And he used to fire off a sawn off 303 rifle just behind people's ears to test their battle readiness. All this sort of. And I thought, should I use my blood knock, which causes most complaints because Americans can't understand it? Tell you this, guess on the hands of heart. And I thought, no, I'll do a Norfolk. I can't do a Norfolk. He was from Norfolk, I think, Robert Scott. So I settled for Cornish pirate. Well, lads, you're going. And the number of complaints we got. Just did it more. But do you know what? There's not, for a start, neither of us can do a proper Scottish. So all you'll get on the Fife and Forfire is before we start a quote, because neither of us can do a proper Scottish accent, despite both of us, actually, most of our ancestors being Scottish, as I presume yours are.
Indeed.
All four of my grandparents are Scottish. That's why they're so miserable, I think. And Gary's even more Scottish, if you know what I mean. And also, because the tank stuff, sometimes it's because we know what's going to happen. So we laid off the accents there because they've been coming back recently in other topics. So there you go. Hey, I'm glad you're getting complaints.
Always the accents. I love it. Actually, the one I love the most is whenever you do someone who's just a bit posh, some posh officer or something like that, and your posh accent comes. That's actually my favourite. Your Australian's not too bad, so we don't get many complaints about the Australian. But
my Australian's terrible. Cheers, mate.
Perfect. Jeez, it's like you're from Melbourne, mate.
You hate being from Melbourne, you told me. That's a bit more trouble.
Let the record show. Mate, it's always a pleasure to catch up. We haven't broken down the history very much, but it was not what I wanted to do on this podcast. No. I wanted to talk about, you know, if people want the history of what is a compelling story, they can read the book and listen to the podcast. But it's a fascinating story, and it takes a Peter Hart to tell it. And you know, it's. I think a lot of us listening to this or watching this video are excited. There's a new Peter Hart book coming out because you do it in a very special way. And I'll stop kissing your ass now, mate, because I know it's not what you like. But it is deserved. It is deserved Thanks. Praise. It is deserved praise, mate. That the way you do it, you don't see it, but it is a very important contribution. The work that you've done with oral history, and it's a great book. The book is Burning Steel. Ooh. By Peter Hart. The podcast, Pete and Gary's Military History, which we enjoy putting out every week. Check it out as well. And the special dedicated episodes off the back of the book are something special as well. Mate, what's coming up? You said you've got the new book you're working on now.
Well, I'm
tell us, what are the new projects in Peter Hart's life?
Well, I and Gary have a book coming out called Laugh or Cry, The British Soldier on the Western Front, 1914-18, which I really enjoyed writing with Gary. This is our first joint book, and it was a joint process. I couldn't have done it without him. I really couldn't. And basically, it's looking at how soldiers kept going. And you and I both know that soldiers use humour. And it's every sort of humour. There's situationalist stuff long before Monty Python. There's sarcasm. The voice of the sergeant talking to a young inexperienced officer is something to behold, or a fussy major. There's sort of abuse, and I've always really enjoyed abuse. But basically, they're trying to keep going in circumstances where any normal person couldn't. But they have to, and they are normal, and so they reach humour is a large part of it. And some of the black humour is appalling, but we've put it in the book anyway, and not for cheap laughs. The book isn't a book of cheap laughs. I think you read an early version of it, or saw an early version. So that's very exciting. That's coming out in November this year. And the other book I'm writing on my own, because otherwise Gary would get all my money, is on the 16th Durham Light Infantry, which is just been, again, an eye-opener of what the infantry have to go through. They fought through North Africa with First Army and then across into Italy, back for a rest to Egypt and Palestine, and then back into Italy, and then on to Greece, which is an unusual thing. Again, personal experience. And I did those before I did the, so they're younger. And my hero in that one is a chap called Ronald Elliott. And I looked it up, and he was 65 when I interviewed him. I thought he was an old man then, because I was about whatever I am, you know, but now I'm 67, I think. Mm. But their voices are young and vigorous. They sound like we do. They haven't got to that 95-year-old still. You know, they're young still. Well, they're not young, but their voice hasn't gone. We all saw Paul McCartney. I love Paul McCartney at Glastonbury. People keep going on and on that his voice has gone. The man's 80. His voice is much better than my voice. I'm in a band as well. His voice is 10 times better than mine. But it's not the Paul McCartney when he was 50 or even 60. It's going a bit. He's, you know, and that's one of the things about oral history. If you catch people young, you get a younger man. Because you have to remember that they're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. And yet you're interviewing someone 60 to 100. You've got to remember that perspective. I'm rabbiting on.
No, you're not at all, Pete. It's why we have you on here. It's fantastic stuff.
It's so the rabbiting you enjoy.
The rabbiting. It's the rabbits that we get you on for. But the current book is Burning Steel. Laugh or Cry with Gary Bain is coming out. And do we know what the book on the Durham Light Infantry is going to be called yet, Pete?
Foot Slogger. No imagination. Foot Slogger.
Wow. Fantastic.
I'm looking forward to that. It's coming out next year. Obviously, it's got to be handed in November. So it's a treadmill writing books. But that makes it sound like I don't enjoy doing it. But you start one, and then the moment you finish, you're on the next one, and you carry on that till you die. Hopefully, I've got at least another 10 books in me.
Mate, we look forward to all of them. And this one, I think, you know, I've enjoyed all your books, but this one in particular is a gripping account. So, mate, like always, a real pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks, Matt. We look forward
to more books and more podcasts in the future. Peter Hart, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Matt. Enjoyed it. Cheers, mate.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.